last night, I attended the meeting at the Central Church over on McRae Street and heard an old classmate of mine preach, and I'd not seen him for nearly 25 years. His name is Ed Harrell. He and I were in school together at Lipscomb. I remember distinctly the Greek class we had together. He would study about 10 minutes a day on it and make straight A's, never miss a breathing mark or an accent mark. I studied 5 hours a day outside of class, every day, 5 days a week, and never made more than a B. He was brilliant, to say the least. He went on and got his PhD degree in history at Vanderbilt University, a very prestigious school. He's written 4 books of superior academic quality. And last night he was preaching to about 50 people on a snow-covered night. And I say all that simply to say that he's still a very humble and God-fearing man. And I have great respect for him. But I want to make some observations now about some of the things that he said, because they're worth our hearing. In commenting on the roots of division in the Restoration Movement, he made a lesson on a very appropriate theme. We are a part of a Restoration Movement. I'm hoping, and I'm taking it for granted, that you're aware of this. And he addressed himself to the subject of the roots of our division. We're a divided people. And he observed that it was not the instrument of music that caused the division in 1906. For one thing, he said, the division didn't occur in 1906. The division began and was completed, really, in fact, years before 1906, but it was only made public in 1906. But for another fact, he says that it was not the instrument that caused that division, but rather an attitude toward the Scriptures that allowed the division to form around an instrument of music, or at least to come to a head around that subject. He said it was an attitude toward the Scriptures that allowed it, and the attitude could have manifested itself in 100 other ways, and it later on did. He says that the church also, it must be observed that the church split pretty much down cultural and economic lines. You know, the church in 1906 split essentially between the churches of Christ and what came to be known as the Christian church, the disciples of Christ. But he says, and this is something that we may know, but we've not drawn any conclusions from it, that division really came pretty much down through cultural and economic lines that was made. The rich city churches of the north, almost without exception, went with the Christian church. It was taken away. They began to practice the innovations, the instrument, the missionary society, the pastor system. The poorer, rural churches of the south, almost all went with the churches of Christ, of which we're a part, which at the time of the split in 1906, we had about 100,000 members, and I think he said we had 4 or maybe 6 full-time gospel preachers supported full-time. So he made these observations that kind of startled you. And he also said in observation regarding a question, you know, we began as a unity movement. That was the whole point. The division that was in the world and among religious people was, they believed, a curse and an affront to God. They began as a unity movement. And it came to a head when 2 movements that were distinct from one another as far as origins were so nearly identical in nature that they came together and united their efforts. That was the real kind of the beginning of this unity movement known as the Restoration Movement in America. And he says, in answer to this question, how could a movement that began with such an emphasis on unity, how could those people who started out so united end up dividing over instruments and missionary societies and the pastor system? How could those people do such a thing? And he made this answer. He said, they didn't. They didn't do it. Their children and their grandchildren did it. And you know what? That brings in you and me, doesn't it? That's where we come in. Because you and I, our grandfathers and our fathers, they were the ones who were the outgrowth of the 1906 division. They were the ones who stood and said, we'll not be influenced by the others. We'll not have the instrument. We'll not be a part of the missionary society. We're not going to have the pastor system. They were our fathers and grandfathers that took that stand. And let me tell you something. You are the grandchildren and the children of those people. So am I. Well, what difference does that make? It simply must be observed that the first generation of a host of Reformation and Restoration movements, almost without exception, rejected the instrument. The first generation did. Luther called it the devil's whistle box. Luther was a very colorful character. In fact, some of his descriptions border on the risque. Sure enough, he was just downright abusive sometimes. He called it the devil's whistle box. Charles Wesley said of the Methodist movement, you know, they wouldn't have the instrument in their movement either. He said, we do not object to the instrument of music in our assemblies, provided it is neither seen nor heard. Charles Spurgeon, the great Baptist preacher of London in the 19th century, the latter 1800s, he refused to let the instrument be used in their assembly. They sang a cappella. And incidentally, the word a cappella came from, we learned recently from Ken Davis, it means like they did it in the church. It used to be that there never was an instrument in the worship service. In fact, the Catholic Church had popes long before they had pipes. That's right. And those who reformed and who wanted to get back to the original way of doing it and get back to the scriptures, those people, the first generation, and this is not exactly totally true, but it's almost true. It's true almost without an exception that the first generation always rejected the instrument of music as being inappropriate and unscriptural and without authority. It was the second or third or fourth generations that allowed it to come in. Later generations, lacking that pioneer conviction that we're going to do what we're authorized to do, we're limited to the authority of Jesus Christ, those generations that lack that conviction allowed it to seep into their assemblies and into their worship hours, their public corporate worship, and they began to practice it. And something else that he said, that unless there was this conviction, unless there was an outright spoken, accepted conviction that we're going to restore what God has authorized, he says, unless there is that conviction, both then and now, he said, that which will more than likely determine whether or not you end up in an instrumental church or a non-instrumental church will be your social or economic status. Now, that kind of scares you, too. And this is the way I would apply that, and it's true. He said that, or he didn't say it, but I'm going to say it, that which, say, today would determine whether you girls would end up in an instrumental or a non-instrumental church would depend on whom you married. If you married an auto mechanic, or if you married, say, a carpenter who worked for wages for somebody else, you'd probably end up in a non-instrumental church. If you married a doctor, according to the world standards, who is very rich, or some lawyer, or someone who makes a lot of money, and your social status increased and your financial status increased, more than likely you'd end up in an instrumental church. unless you have conviction that you're going to do what God says and you search it out and then stand by it very firmly. Now, that's kind of upsetting, isn't it? Now, today the issue will most likely not be over the instrument. And some of you, I'm sure, probably are not really all that concerned about restoration things and whether the instrument is or isn't. And that's one of the reasons why I'm preaching on it. Because you've got to see this, or else you'll be one of the ones who will become the victims of not an identical digression. There won't be probably in the church another digression that will involve the instrument of music. I don't think the devil cares two hoots whether we use the instrument or not. Now, he's already split us once over it. He'll go get him another boogaboo and use it on us. So don't be going around looking for the instrument and looking for somebody that's going to bring the instrument in and then pounce on him with all 4 feet. Don't do that. You're not going to ever find him. There'll be some other issue that will be brought in by Satan to test you and me. And you know what the test will be? The test will be whether or not you're going to do what the Lord authorizes. There's the test. I don't believe it'll be over the instrument. But for the sake of our series on the morning hours, when lately we've been studying the internals and externals, I want to press this issue because I want you to see a principle. Is there any authority in the Scriptures for the use of mechanical instruments in Christian worship? And the answer is simply no. No, it's not. There simply is no authority for it. The question of authority is appropriate too. When you say, what do you mean by authority? You're always talking about authority. The question of authority is appropriate. Jesus introduced it himself. When he asked the Jews, tell me, he said, the baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men? Well, why would he ask such a foolish question as that? Because it wasn't foolish. The question was very appropriate then and now. In other words, he was saying, if it was not from God, then it must be from man. They didn't know how to answer him. And then at the end of the Christian revelation, John, in about the year 95, wrote and said, brethren, don't believe every prophet. Or don't believe every spirit. He said, try the spirits to see whether they're from God or not. Because, he said, there are many false prophets gone out into the world. So Jesus just simply talked about things being from God or from men. John talked about us trying the spirits, trying those who say things. He said, find out whether they're from God or men, because there are a lot of false prophets gone out into the world. And then when you simply put this, say, put the instrument of music, the mechanical instrument of music, the pipes, the playing, the pianos, and all the droning of all the whistle boxes of the devil, all of this that Luther would call it, when you put all that to the test, is it from heaven or from men? You come to the conclusion it's from men. Now, the question of authority strikes right at the heart of Christianity, really. It was Luke that recorded Jesus by saying, he said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do the things that I say? Luke 6:46. Why do you call me Lord and don't do what I say? And then it was Peter who said in 1 Peter 4:11, if any man speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. And it was Paul who wrote to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 4:6 and says that we ought not to go beyond the things that are written. Now, I don't think Jesus or Peter or Paul had in mind at all the instrument of music. I don't think it crossed their mind. They did have in mind a principle. A principle. That not only the instrument of music, but everything else that we do as far as in word or deed, it's all to be done by the authority of Christ, Paul told the Colossians. Whatever you do in word or deed, do it all by the authority of Christ. That's what he said. Now, I don't know whether you give two hoots whether or not that's done or not. And I'll guarantee you, if you don't, then you'll be like those people back in 1906 or so and before. You'll end up in the nearest church that's most convenient, and you couldn't care one whit about whether you have authority for what you do or not. That's exactly where you'll be. And as far as you're concerned, then the movement that began back in the 18th century in this land that was determined to speak where the Bible speaks and be silent where the Bible is silent, as far as you're concerned, it will go by the board. You will not have one thing to do with it. And as far as you're concerned, it'll die. Unless you're convicted that you're going to do everything that you do in word or deed by the authority of Jesus Christ. Now that's Colossians 3, what? 3:17. Well, you know, that sounds like the New Testament is a blueprint, doesn't it? Does, somewhat. You mean to tell me that we've got to go by the New Testament as though it were a blueprint? Well, that is precisely the way the New Testament describes itself. It describes itself as a blueprint or a pattern. And you know what? That is precisely the attitude that you and I are going to have to take toward the New Testament if you and I keep ourselves within the teachings and within the authority of Jesus Christ. There is no way you can accept the New Testament in any other light than come out with the pure New Testament teachings and follow Jesus Christ and let Him be Lord and do whatever we do in word or deed by His authority. You'll have to accept the New Testament as a pattern too. Now you expect the Old Testament to be like that. In Exodus the 25th chapter and verse 40, God warned Moses and said, "You see to it that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you in the mountain." I mean, he laid it on him. As though to say, "I dare you to step outside." He said, "You see to it, Moses. This is your business. You see to it that everything you make is made according to the pattern that I showed you in the mountain." Got with him on it. And you know that it's enforced, and you know it was significant because in Hebrews, the 8th chapter and verse 5, that very statement is quoted verbatim. And the Hebrew writer said, "Remember what God told Moses, see to it that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you in the mountain." He quotes it verbatim and says that was a significant statement. And we expect that of the Old Testament. They were so picky. Man, they were nitpicky. And everything had to be either wave offered or heave offered or so many parts of this. But you know, the New Testament is called a pattern in the same way. In fact, the word, if you look at 2 Timothy 1:13, I'm going to show you something. 2 Timothy 1:13 uses the word. Get your finger there in Hebrews 8:5. I'm going to give you, that's the quotation about the Old Testament pattern. In Hebrews 8:5, it says, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you in the mountain." And then look at 2 Timothy 1:13. "Follow the pattern of sound words which you've heard from me in the faith and love which are in Christ Jesus." The word pattern is found there. It's the same word, except that it's a verb form in 2 Timothy 1:13, and it's a noun in Hebrews 8:5. But it's the same word, tupos, type or pattern. So you see, he says, you follow the pattern. Moses was told, follow the pattern. Paul told Timothy, follow the pattern. Look at 1 Timothy 6:20 and 21. It's the same opening probably. The very last charge of Paul to Timothy was this: "Oh, Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to you. Avoid the godless chatter and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge. Guard what you have been committed." But look at Titus 1 and 9. Just flip over a couple of pages. Titus 1 and 9 lays a charge on the elders of every congregation that they are to be, that they must hold firm to the sure word as taught, so that he may be able, this elder, each elder, he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also to confute those who contradict it. For there are many insubordinate men, empty talkers, deceivers, especially of the circumcision party. Said, so be careful. The elders are charged with the responsibility of being able to teach this pattern and bring people to it, to instruct in it, and to conflict or to contradict those and to dispute with those who would go against it. So you see, the New Testament is also a pattern. He must hold to the firm word, to the sure word, as taught. He wants it to be done as he was taught the word. He said, you hold on to that. So that's a pattern. Now, here's what then it boils down to. The Old Testament was a pattern. It was to be held to. The New Testament, though, is a pattern. Then it's not a matter of whether the Old was specific and the New is not specific. That's not it. It's not a matter of whether God was intent on making the Old or New a pattern and the New not a pattern. That's not it. The issue is simply this, is what the Old was to be a pattern of and what the New is to be a pattern of. That's the only difference. The Old was specific about a shadow. The Old was specific about a shadow. The shadow here, you can see a shadow on a wall. The Old was specific about the shadow. In fact, if you look at that 8:5, it simply says there that to make everything according to the pattern that was shown you. But flip on over to the 10th chapter in verse 1, and you'll see that he just simply says that was just a shadow. For since the law was but a shadow of the good things to come, instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices continually offered year after year, make perfect those who draw near. He says that was just a shadow. The old was specific about a shadow. The new is specific about the reality. When Jesus said the new worship, the hour is coming and now is when those that worship the Lord, when worship, those who worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. They must worship him on the plane of the spirit and in the realm of reality or truth. He was saying simply that we must be specific regarding that which is the real and not that which was the shadow. Contrasting the physical with the spiritual. The old was specific about the physical things. The old was specific about the shadow. The new is specific also, but it's about different things. It's specific about the reality. And listen, to save my life, I cannot imagine God going to such degree and to such an extent and to such an extreme degree to be so specific about a shadow if it was not important that the details of the body itself or the reality itself were, if that's not important. You see what I'm saying? If it was important to make the shadow exact, surely it's important to make the essence itself exact. And so we mustn't fall into the trap of saying, oh, he was specific only about the Old Testament. That we're at liberty to do... No, you're not at liberty to do anything you want to do in the New Testament. You're at liberty precisely to do everything that you do in word or deed by the authority of Jesus Christ. That's exactly what you have the liberty to do. And you say, oh, rubbish, I don't believe that. Then I'll tell you what, you are probably not a part of this movement at all. Because that is the basis upon which this movement was begun, and it is the basis upon which this movement will have to be perpetuated. Now, you may want to start another movement. Fine, have at it. But if you're going to be a part of this movement that was based upon this principle, that everything that we do was to be done in according to the authority of Jesus Christ, and that we would speak where the Bible speaks and be silent where the Bible is silent, then we'll have to agree that we're going to have to be specific about the realities, just like the Old Testament was specific about the shadow. Well, you say, well, I'm not all that interested in that sort of thing. Well, you can probably do one of two things. Then you can just ride along while other people take the responsibility and go on, and you just be what you are because your parents were that. And you know, there's some of you that are here today that are just what you are because your parents were that. And you may continue to be what you are because you're scared of your granddaddy. He was that too, you know. And you're scared to death to bring an instrument in or even say that you think it's all right because your granddaddy would turn over in his grave. Or you may be still living, he'd just thrash you with an inch of your life. And that may be the only reason why you don't use a pipe or an organ here today. Well, you need to find out why you're where you are. You know, I feel odd about pressing this, and I don't want to be ugly. But listen, I'm talking about a movement that I'm so convicted is real and right, and I'm so convicted about the fact that there is no way that God's people on earth can continue as God's people without an absolute conviction that we must speak where the Bible speaks and be silent where the Bible is silent. I don't think you can maintain a healthy restoration movement without that basis. Instrument, spinstrument, what difference does it make? That's right, that's not the issue. The issue is whether or not you're going to do everything you do by the authority of Jesus Christ. And I've committed myself. I may make a wrong application, but I've committed myself. I'm going to do what he says, and I'm going to have his authority backing everything that I do. Well, I wish I had a chart up here this morning, but I want to show you how that do you believe we ought to use the instrument in the worship? You don't? Oh, you're wrong. We've got to have the instrument. How many of you believe we ought to use an instrument in our singing? Let me see your hands. If you think we ought to use an instrument. You don't? A boy over in Rome, Italy once, an Italian asked me, we came through there in 70, he said, Brother Woodruff, do you think we should use the instrument of music, the instrument in our worship? I said, I believe it is absolutely essential. He was a Christian, a new Christian. You know, it had been droned into him. He thought he'd asked me the wrong question. His English wasn't all that good. He said, do you think it is all right to use an instrument in our singing? I said, I believe it is absolutely essential. He asked me the third time. You should have seen it. I shouldn't have done him that way. He said, do you think it is all right to... And he went, I said, I believe it is absolutely essential. And I said, now forgive me. I'm trying to teach you a lesson. I said, God has an instrument for the Christian to use. It's his heart. Oh, he broke out with his great big grin. I said, it's his heart. That's the instrument of the Christian worship. Now watch. Look at this contrast. I'm going to just use it with my hands. In the Old Testament, they had these priests. Who is the priest? The high priest in that time was a priest on earth. Who is our high priest? Jesus Christ. The regular, ordinary priest in that time who stood in the temple for the people. Who is that priest today? We are. Every Christian is a priest. What about the temple itself? Back here it was made out of brick and mortar or stone and mortar. What is the temple today? The Christian's body. That's where God dwells. The incense that they used in worship back there. What is our incense today? The prayers of the saints, John says, are the incense. What are the sacrifices? Back here they had bulls and goats and doves and all pigeons. What are the sacrifices today in the Christian age? It's our lives. He said, let your bodies be living sacrifices. There's the difference. Back there in the Old Covenant, they used instruments of music. From flutes to sackbuts and all the rest, they were all back there. Odd sounding, but they had them. What is the instrument today? Did they use them? Yes, they used them. In worship to God? Yes. What's the instrument today that God desires in this new age when we worship God in spirit and in truth, in reality? What's the instrument? Your heart. And just as surely as we don't have a high priest on earth, and he's Christ, and just as surely as we don't have any more priests, that we're the priest, that we don't have a temple, that we're the temple, that they're not in the sacrifices, but us, our own bodies are sacrificing. Just in that same vein of thinking, there are no more of these mechanical, temporal, earthly instruments of music to accompany our singing. The heart, the mind of man is his instrument. And you ask me the question, is it necessary to have the instrument of music? Yes, indeed. It's not only permissible, it is absolutely essential to have the instrument of music in your worship. Ephesians 5:19 simply says to sing and make melody in your heart. And then Colossians 3:16 says the same thing. Singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord. That's the instrument. And you know, we ought never to be ashamed to make our stand. It's the most biblical. It's the stand that most nearly comes in tune with the reality of the Christian religion, which is one of spirit and in truth. There's no visible thing that comes nearer to portraying the reality of that kind of worship than just simply to say the instrument that we use is our mind. As we tune our hearts and minds into God and express our songs of praise, that's the new age. Don't ever be ashamed to make that stand. Go home and study about it. And also, let's never be guilty of failing to use the instrument that God requires, your heart. Don't ever be ashamed to use that. And be ashamed if you don't use it. You better make sure that you use that instrument. But don't be ashamed to simply stand up before the world and say, no, we don't use the mechanical instrument, we use the instrument that God requires, that is the heart. All right, think about these things. We're going to close now and just simply turn our attention to those in the assembly. If there's someone here who is in need of some assistance, if you are not a Christian, we want you to become one. You may say, well, that's too narrow for me. I don't want to let everything I do be done by the authority of Jesus. Well, I'm sorry, but that's where we are, and that's where you'll have to be if you're a part of us. Or you may be a member of the church that simply says, look, I don't believe that. I don't think that that's what ought to be. Well, I'm sorry about that too. I tell you what let's do. Let's have a feedback class this morning over in the New Bible building. in the southeast corner. Let's have a feedback class and see if we... And if you'd like to discuss it, come on. This is what it's all about. Let's get over there and we'll talk about it this morning. All right, let's stand and encourage one another while we sing.